Welcome to another episode of The Final Block. I am Chris Barry, and this is the podcast from British Judo where we speak to generally GB coaches and support staff in the World Class Performance Programme. I'm joined once again by Denny Roberts. How are you doing, Denny?
How are you doing, Chris? So I'm really looking forward to this episode.
Indeed, so am I. We've got a very special guest on, not somebody from the World Class Performance Programme on this occasion, but actually the legend that is the voice of judo, Neil Adams. How you doing, Neil?
I'm doing great, thank you. Yeah, really good. I'm lucky. I'm very lucky that I have we just built a dojo for filming purposes, but we're able to still able to do the bit of judo, which I think a lot of people are craving at the moment. But yeah, doing great, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an absolute luxury for you, and the judo community is just, as you say, craving the judo at the moment.
I think we got a lot of judo nuts. I think we can honestly say that we're all judo nuts. That's all right to say, but you know, we love the sport, and we realize how much we miss it. I think when, you know, because we're a physical contact sport as well, you know, so we need that physical contact, and we need to be able to mix it. You know, it's there's nothing like actual physical contact, and we can't do that at the moment, but we'll get there.
Are you enjoying some of the content that's been put out by the judo nuts, as you describe them, online and stuff like that? And I've seen some of the dancing videos from yourself that are obviously quite creative. It's really enjoyable to watch some of it. Have you seen most of it? Or
I've seen a lot of it. You know, I've seen a lot of content going out, and a lot of the fun stuff I think is great because it just shows the spirit, you know, is there from everybody. When it comes to the technical stuff and people wanting to demonstrate their expertise, I think that probably a high percentage of it is a little bit suspect. And it does worry me a little bit, you know, some of the technical stuff that people put out there without having the real knowledge to put it out there. And so what we've tried to do is to put out informative stuff that people can take, you know, for example, the bands and the uchikomi that they're able to do at home. And if they're going to do it with bands, then do it with the right length, the right resistance, and do it with enough space that they can do a full rotation. And, you know, I see people coming on there saying, yeah, I've done 300, 400, 5,000, you know, 1,000 of these, and it's 1,000 of what, you know, and it does worry me more than a little bit, I have to say. So the answer to your question, the fun stuff, I think, is great because it keeps our spirit together. And if you're going to do technical stuff, make sure that you do it correctly. It's everybody can get tired. We can run, we can do sprints, we can do circuits, and everybody can get tired. But if we're going to do skills orientated stuff, then we need to make sure it's good quality.
I totally agree. You know, some of the stuff I've seen has been amazing and fun and enjoyable to watch, the creative stuff. But yeah, I do worry, not just the technical judo, even just across the board, is in some of the exercises and some of the movement stuff that people are doing. I'm like, the physios and doctors are going to be really busy after this lockdown, I think, correcting some of the sort of hips and joints of some people for the exercises they're doing. Yeah, and yeah, I'm very protective over the movement sort of element of judo, and I think there's a lot to be learned from using the bands in terms of technical stuff. So yeah, I totally agree that you need to be mindful.
I think so. Just go to the stuff that's technically sound, and people that are delivering it are technically sound. You know, I know that I haven't got a very good voice, and I don't think I'd go online telling people how to sing a song. I'm trying to be kind, guys, right? So anyway, I won't take it any further.
Neil, so we brought you on the show, and we want to talk about the highs and lows of your career, really. And there's so many more highs than there is lows, but yeah, the real sort of stuff and the thoughts and feelings and the sort of experiences that you've had. Can we kick off from your sort of first ever games experience, and then sort of can you take us through the sort of next ones? Yeah, just all the sort of experiences that you've had.
I was very fortunate that I had, we don't have it so much now, but as a cadet, I was traveling with the senior team and able to, they were in the position at the time where they, you know, the team manager kind of saw potential in me. So he took me to Japan and then sent me to the senior European Championships as a cadet. I was still a cadet. And I was first reserve. I went head to head with Vass Morrison in the final of the British Open. I think I was only 17 at the time, and I lost on a decision. Quite rightly, Vass went to the Olympics, but I was first reserve for that Olympic game. So I had my very first build up to the 76 Montreal Olympic Games as a young cadet, you know, and I remember watching Vass fighting for third place. So I was kind of up there round about, and I was a bit peeved because I know that Ezio Gamba went to the 76 Olympic Games, fought, got through three rounds while he was out there. I think it would have been a great experience for me, but don't get me wrong. I don't think that, I think Vass was the man. He was the one to go. And so my first Olympic experience was as a reserve, but I did 2 years of the preparation for that Games. And of course, 4 years later, and I watch it so often now because I'm watching almost all of the matches that are the qualification matches at the Grand Prix, Grand Slams. And I see some of the Brazilians putting some of their juniors out 6 years prior to a Games, they have 2 years of one Olympic cycle, and then they're right in there for the next 4 years. And I saw it with a few of their Olympic medalists that have come through and won Olympic titles. You know, they've kind of had an early Olympic experience, whether it's going to the Olympic Games or just going through the preparation of. And when I came into Moscow, of course, I was one of the favorites for the gold medal. You know, 4 years later, I was one of the favorites. And so came in there, still quite young. I was still 21, you know, and ready to go. And of course, I lost on a split decision in the final of that Olympic Games to Ezio Gamba. But crazy thing was, I'd beaten him a month earlier in the final of the European Championship, so I would have kind of swapped that one. And just unfortunate
that so you're in the Olympic final, you're up against someone that you've beaten before previously. How are you feeling going into that Olympic final? Are you confident? Are you nervous? What's the game plan? What was going through your mind then?
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Somebody said to me, they said that, are you nervous? You know, so often you hear people say, are you nervous? And you go, yeah, I am, but I'm excited, you know. And I've had times when people have asked me whether I'm nervous. And when I go, yeah, I'm excited, right, because I really want to get it on, that's different to being really, really nervous. Sometimes they're kind of connected, but actually, the best performances I've ever had is when I'm excited, nervous. And I remember going into the World Championships in 81, didn't think I was going to lose it. I knew that I was absolutely on top of my game. When I started the day, nothing was going to go wrong. You know, it was just, everything was, it would have taken a miracle to somebody to beat me. Not a miracle, but, you know, it would have taken a lot. And I think, you know, when we look at that performance from Gray and Randall at the 99 World Championships, and I wrote in, they showed his photograph, and I said, nobody would have wanted to have fought him on that day. You know, it was just, everything was aligned, and, you know, every physical thing was aligned, and his mental application was aligned, and he was on home ground. And on that particular occasion, being on home ground was an advantage to him. I don't think it's an advantage to everybody, but to him it was. But for the World Championships, I was very excited. And for that Olympics, I was excited as well. You know, I just wanted to get it on. I didn't think I was going to lose it, you know. And I think that having a long break in between my semi-final and my final made a difference to me, because I went straight through upon every match all the way through to the final. So I just thought it was going to happen the same. And then when I started with Ezio in the final, it was a shock and horror as to what, you know, it wasn't the same. I kind of had to start again. And it was halfway through, I kind of started to rescue the match. But anyway, in the end, he got the decision quite correctly, I think, you know. But I had the same thing happen in the final of the World Championships in 83, which I thought I'd won. But that's another story. But, you know, I'm always quite honest about the decisions that I've lost or decisions that I think I've won. Third Olympic, because we were talking about the Olympic, my third Olympic experience was my third Olympic Games. And I didn't prep the same for that Olympic Games. One of the reasons, my son was about 4 or 5 years of age. And my third Olympic Games was totally different. And I haven't talked about my second one, have I? Los Angeles, I went in as favourite as well. Weight up. Los Angeles, I was so physically tired, mentally tired, and couldn't get my game up at all. I just struggled all the way through the whole day. Was winning the final 3 minutes, well, winning the final quite comfortably, but really hard work, and then made a mistake on the edge of the mat, got thrown, you know, debatable whether it was Ippon, but it wouldn't be now. But I mean, anyway, it was then. And so I lost my second Olympic final and devastated, absolutely devastated. You know,
no, did losing your first Olympic final, did that give you the motivation to do another cycle? As in, like, you've got unfinished business, I need to go again. And what was your training like? You spent time in Japan, in France, and these places, I believe, no?
Yeah, I absolutely determined to get it right. Probably overtrained for the second one, in as that, you know, that was always my problem. It wasn't undertraining, it was overtraining, you know, because I just needed it and I wanted it so badly. And so I'd always be there and I'd always be in the gym, and I never not do it. You know, I'd do more rather than less. And so I think that for the second Olympic Games, it was again just too much, a lot of pressure on, because I was one of the favorites in 78 weight up. And so when I went there, there was a lot of pressure on me, and I felt the pressure. I think, you know, that was it was a really tough day. I remember fighting Novak in the quarterfinals, and I mean, normally with Novak, one of the strongest guys in the world, and normally he'd be on me for 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes, and then I'd feel his power go, and then my muscular endurance work that I did would normally take over, and then I'd come back at him and win the match. I'd fought him 7 times, never lost to him. And this Olympic Games, he never stopped coming, you know. And by the time I got to the semi-final, I was knackered. I was really in the training area, waiting for the semis, you know. And I had Lesak of Yugoslavia, who I'd never lost to. I'd always thrown him for Ippon, and even he gave me a hard time in the semis. But So it was, different.
Neil, going into the second final of the games, you're coming up against someone that you'd beat previously again?
Yes, I mean, Frank was just a young up-and-coming German guy, came up on the opposite side, and they were happy for him to have this. I mean, this me talking to him and also to his doctors and his coaches and friends now. Of course we are, you know, but, they were kind of happy that he got to the final. So they would have been happy with the silver medal at that particular time in his career. 4 years later was different for him because he was one of the favourites. But a brief second mistake. And I just remember something going through my head. And it was, he just turned in with the left Sienagi, did a right Uchimata and the left Sienagi, and it was kind of blindside. And I went over, if I could do it all over again, you know, people say, would you change anything, you know? And I'd say, yeah, I'd move two steps to the left or one step to the right.
Neil, okay, so you've heard Ippon being called in the Olympic final again. What's going through your mind then? And explain that journey from sort of coming off the mat, collecting your stuff, going back to your room. Like, what are you thinking there? I mean, this is twice now, and are you thinking, okay, I'm going for a third, or are you thinking I'm done, or like, where are you in that moment?
I was going to retire after that Olympic Games as Olympic champion. You know, it's the only tournament I hadn't won. And I remember I came off and I squatted down at the end of the mat. Colin McIver was the team manager, right? So Colin McIver was in shock. I was in shock as well, you know, and I said to him, and I said, I've made a mistake. And he's very dry, Colin McIver. He said, you choose your moments. and that was that. And then we had a couple of drinks that night. Probably not the best time to have a couple of drinks, but it was one of those where I needed a long rest and I needed to do something different. It was coming to that stage in my life anyway. It wasn't my age or my physical side of it, just more mental, I think, the pressures mentally. Because every time I went out, everybody expected me to win a medal. You know, I was, every European, I did 12 European championships, 12 times I won medals at European championships. And then every Worlds and every Olympic Games that I did, you know, so it was high expectation for me to bring something back. And sometimes I felt that pressure, you know, it was something that I tried to keep inside. I mean, a lot of the time I reveled in it because I could kind of put myself behind it all and still perform. But sometimes I did feel the pressure, and it was something that I remember I needed a rest after Los Angeles. I needed to give it a break. And then I went to Paris for a year to teach at the Racing Club de France. And that was my first kind of coaching appointment that I had. And of course, you know, and I see it with a lot of the fighters now from 30 to 40, they have some of their best rendering time. Because the pressure suddenly goes off them, and they're able still. I mean, like Ilias, prime example, right? Ilias is still a monster. Probably on a one-off with anybody in the world, he'd probably still beat most of them. But doing five on the trot, five matches against monsters, it's different, especially with the psychological part, you know. And then so, from 30 to 40, you have your best randori time, because in the dojo, no pressure. And so you perform well. And I was performing well in the dojo and practicing with the French team and taking most of them out. And they just said, you've got to try for that Olympic Games again. You know, you need to, because physically you're still there, you know. And so I decided that I would do it. And I always think, you know, when people say about comebacks, and I always look at, and I, you know, that we see this Tyson thing, you know, I mean, at his age now, and it's ridiculous, really. I mean, it's just, it is ridiculous, you know, and also dangerous. And I, you know, I had to get to 40, I think, and I did the 88 Olympics, didn't do the same preparation because my youngster was young. I didn't want to be away from family. Thought I could do most of my preparation from home. So I didn't go to Japan as many times and didn't do as many camps as I had done before. And it all stems on rendering. I tell you now, I don't care what training programs you've got, and I don't care how much physical work you do, I don't care how physically strong you are, but if you haven't got the renderers in there, it's like a marathon runner trying to keep the same pace up 26 miles. If he hasn't got the miles in his legs, then he's not going to do it. And so the rendery side of it is imperative. And I think that at the moment is what in GB we're struggling with. I think that worldwide at the moment with this pandemic, everybody's realizing that they need the renderers. You know, I think even in Japan, where they've got them on hold, they've got everybody there, you know, of course, with the distance in at the moment, they'll be struggling, you know, and I think they'll struggle when they start to come back in and they'll realize the same problems that we've always had, you know, to get the renderers.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that, Neil. It's absolutely the most like vital training unit that you have in the sport of judo. You have to be able to do randori practice. Without that, you don't really have that feel or the stimulus for how you need to go about doing your judo and how it's going to feel when you're out in competition. Equally, you mentioned a little bit that your focus shifted a little bit in the build-up to the Seoul Games, and you had more of a family sort of focus than a judo focus. This was obviously kind of the end of your career as well. And how did you find the sort of going from the real, real highs of that to then moving away from judo and trying to move your focus completely elsewhere?
It was hard, you know, and I think a lot of people find it very difficult. I mean, I look at Teddy Riner now and you know, the problems that he's probably having. I understand them 100%. I understand Ilias. You know, I speak to Ilias a lot and I understand exactly where he is, you know, and all, you know, the training that he's doing, the physical training. A lot of people are asking him why he's still doing it. And he said, because I can, you know, but then there comes a time in your life when you physically can't. And so you adapt. And I think that as long as you adapt in the right way, you know, and I think physically and mentally, I think it's a really difficult thing to cope with. And for me, for example, I went through some really, you know, some lows in as that as far as work commitments were concerned and as far as, you know, what being able to do my job as a coach. I mean, I was very young and I had to learn just as all of you, you know, have had to do, you know, you have to learn your craft. And actually, when I was probably better at it, you know, it's the wrong time because actually coaching position at the moment is really for young coaches to be out there. You know, it's better equipped for young coaches that are that haven't got family commitments and things like that to be out there. But they're the least experienced. So I think it's probably better if young coaches have got an overseer that's kind of directing and suggesting certain things. And I think that, you know, for me, I found it difficult. I went through, you know, highs and lows. And of course, at one stage in my life, I found that, you know, because I went through a divorce and I had real lows in my life and I started drinking too much and that started to affect my life a little bit. And it started to affect, I think people, you know, in at one stage kind of started to notice that things weren't quite right. But it was something that I hit head on and it's something that I nailed, you know, and I didn't get any outside help. In the end, it was an incident, something that happened. And my wife saying to me, she said, you know, why are you doing this? And I said, I don't know, really. I don't really know why, because I've got a great family. I have great support. I have beautiful, kids. My kids were amazing. And my wife was beyond amazing. And so why do this? And so I nearly lost my job in Belgium, and they gave me a second chance. And then I just went, I'm stopping. I just stopped. 20th of December, 13 years this December. And I just stopped, and never looked back, So actually didn't struggle with it. I don't crave it. We've got a great bar in the house, and so it's not one of those things that I crave. I think that from a mental point of view, I think that sometimes we look for something to kind of release the pressure. And I've noticed that quite a few people have been doing that during lockdown, because it's just something you do, isn't it? 6 o'clock, it's just about time. It's 6 o'clock, so it's okay. We can have a drink, or we can have a beer, or whatever it is. But I mean, I'm not saying, and I've never said, well, people shouldn't drink as much. But I just think that there is a time for it, and it's certainly not something to do when you're mentally struggling or depressed. And I think that goes for a lot of things. If you're struggling, then the last thing you want to do is be pissed and do it with alcohol. And so that was my thing. And I think some people put on a lot of weight, but they have other things.
Neil, do you think that going from New Adams, the world champion, European champion, and all that pressure that you spoke about earlier from when you finished your last games with a beautiful Taitoshi, I might add, in your last sort of games. But when that all ended, do you think it was like a loss of identity and what you were searching for is perhaps what you found now in your back as Neil Adams, the voice of the whole entire judo federation, and like you're like the David Attenborough of judo to me. Like if I'm watching a fight and you're not commentating on it, it's not official to me. So do you feel it was that loss of identity, and did you struggle with that after you finished the games? You'd always been Neil Adams, the Olympian, but in terms of competing and stuff like that, you wasn't.
Well, I think that is absolutely how it is, isn't it? You have to change your identity. And I was quite fortunate that I had this association with, just by sheer chance, and I did a voiceover for Fighting Films. And it happened to be the first film that they did was Ippon, which was my film of me winning the world championships. So I voiced my own film over, and it was terrible. I mean, it is. The content is great, but it's not the quality that we've got now, of course, because everybody has learned, and we've got such professionalism in fighting films, and we're so lucky to have them, and I've had an association with them now for 36 years, it's amazing.
And did it under one Nippon stuff?
Oh,
I remember them as a kid. I can still do the soundtrack in my head now to the 101 Nippon shows and stuff like that.
You can still get that. I mean, the 101 Ippons are now online, not in cassettes. So you can still get them. But, this was a great chance. I started by accident, and then I started to do a little bit of commentary, so changing the tone of my voice, and then I did some courses, and you talk about David Attenborough and, the absolute brilliance of that man and how he can change and make things sound so interesting. And so when I realized that I had to put my own kind of identity onto it, and it's just something, I mean, I got better at as I went through it, and I think that, it's interesting. I still find it very, very interesting. I love doing it. And I love narrating as well. Narrating is a slightly different pace. and it's a totally different feel when you narrate. And I've narrated a couple of kids' books as well, just to learn to express my voice in different ways. And that is my identity, I guess, now. And also doing more in front of the camera as opposed to behind the camera, because I struggled a little bit in front of the camera, and I good with behind it, but not in front of. So I worked really hard in my in front of camera work as well. So it's something that I keep working at all the time.
You mentioned that kind of excitement that you get building up to performing at an event as an athlete. What is this now the thing that gives you that excitement, commentating and narrating or whatever you're doing in your line of work as a voice of judo?
Yeah, I do get excited because I'm passionate about it, you know, and I am passionate, but I'm not a fanatic. And, you know, we have a lot of people that are fanatical about judo, you know, sometimes I can take a rest from it. Sometimes I just need a little rest. But when I get out there and I'm in there and I'm inside the match and I have an ability to assess situations and I pick up on things that I think might happen or think that things that are building up. And so I use that. And, you know, the expression that you hear in my voice is absolute passion for the sport, you know, I do still absolutely love it. And I'm very fortunate that I now have two different jobs in the IJF, of course, as a referee supervisor, which I'm really enjoying that because all of a sudden that put a different tilt on my judo life because I didn't realize how much I wasn't up to date with the interpretation and rule sets that are put forward. And so I had to study again and get my levels up because if you're going to give advice to anybody or if you're there in front of the top 20 referees, you better know what you're talking about. You know, I see it so often now, coaches out there shouting at the referees and not knowing the rule well enough themselves. It's amazing how many of the top ones don't know specific rules that they're arguing against. So it taught me a lot. And so it's good working with top fighters. There's about eight of us at the moment, former World Olympic champions and stuff, all working together towards the same goal, you know. And I know that some of the rules are not everybody's choice, but I have to say that for me, most of the people that you know are pushing for the leg grabs and you know give us back the old judo, but the old judo was Jigoro Kano's interpretation of bloody judo. You know, not necessarily the leg grabs that came in the 1990s with the wrestling interpretations that were being introduced. So actually, all we've done is gone back, and it's funny. It's the wrestlers that can't do both wrestling and judo now because they have to do the judo, but the judoka can still do the judo and the wrestling. So my advice to the wrestlers is, you know, you've got to learn the judo skills if you want to do both. But that's another podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting contrast, isn't it? Like the pure judoka versus the wrestler judo sort of hybrid. On that note, which fighters bring out the most excitement when you get to watch them compete?
I think, you know, everybody's excited about. I mean, you know, when it comes to presence, Teddy Riner absolutely lights up the place. You know, everybody gets up and leaves to go and watch him. I don't think from a judo point of view that he's the best heavyweight that's ever, you know, ever been, but I think he is the best, the most prolific winner. You know, he knows how to win. That guy knows how to win. And he's a, what I've watched him when people kind of almost baying for something to happen, and he pulls it out the bag, you know. And I think he's just a prolific athlete. He's just an amazing man. When it comes to judo, Ono for me, Maruyama, amazing. The Abes, of course, you know, and I'm sorry that that's all Japanese, but, you know, it's pure technical judo. Ilias Iliadis, you know, he could rip people out the ground. My mate Chris Bowl said to me, he said, the thing is about Ilias is that sometimes his technique didn't always look to be totally coordinated, but that pure raw strength suddenly coordinated enough to throw them for Ippon. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it, you know. But, you know, so sometimes some of the athletes with pure raw determination and power really do it for me. And then the pure judoka, they do as well. Maruyama's Uchimata, incredible. And, you know, if I ask you now what Ono's favorite technique is, what would you say? Denny, I'm asking you.
I want to say Uchimata. But I don't know, Uchimata Toyotoshi maybe, but yeah, I would go.
So it's Osotogari. So you watch him, but his Osotogari sets up his Uchimata. But his Uchimata is secondary, but his Osoto is his favorite. That comes from him. So he actually scores more with Osoto than he does. But of course, when they defend for the Osoto,
he hits the Uchimata.
Uchimata, you know. But interesting, you know. But just pure judoka, and of course Kosei Inoue as well. You know, amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing to see that sort of the art of judo really in that regard, where like it's not that you just got one thing that you're really good at. It's all of these other threats coming together, whether they're tachiwaza or newaza, they all sort of lead you down a path that you don't really want to be going, but you can't help it because they're so good.
Do you like watching the Georgians and the Russians or people like Zantaraya that I feel kind of created like a new element to judo, especially with like more sort of dynamic in terms of escaping and moving. Do you enjoy watching them guys as much? Or the beautiful technical judo that we like to see, but it has sort of a raw wrestling element to it, but I still think obviously it's still a way of winning.
Yeah, I think the brilliance of Zantaraya, when you look at Zantaraya and just the cat-like escapism and also the adapting to situations. You know, I think the Georgians are absolutely phenomenal with that, you know, because they can take a situation that looks as if you're going to throw them and then they'll turn it against you. Zantaraya is the master of it. And I do. I enjoy that aspect of it as well. Do you know, I've said that the pure judo is what I teach, you know, but the brilliance of a judoka, I think, no matter what style, and we've seen a lot of different styles with the Georgians, the Mongolians, and the Japanese, and we see these contrasts of styles clash sometimes. But the absolute brilliance comes from the adaptation of their skills. And their skills are of turning to the Ippon, you know, and different ways of scoring Ippon or countering. And I can't say enough how important it is to have, because I always, when I'm teaching, talk about adapting to situations, you know, and the real winners are the ones that can adapt.
Yeah, I'd 100% agree with that. It's your perfect technique's only perfect until you come up against somebody who knows it's coming. It's like you have to be able to have that adaptability. It's just absolutely crucial. And your reference to the Georgians being the best at being able to do that is absolutely bang on. They've always got that one effort. Doesn't matter how tired they are, how badly they're getting beaten, they've got that one effort, and that can be good night for you. Like, it's a great, amazing to watch, so exciting.
Yeah, and I think that judo is exciting at the moment, you know, with I think for me, it's an absolute plus not having people dive for legs. I really feel strongly about that. I think it would be the worst thing. I think that having it stand up. I commentated at the Olympic Games, the last Olympic Games for judo. I also did Greco-Roman freestyle and I did Taekwondo as well. I commentated the four sports. And I did the freestyle first of all, really interesting. I loved it. I went, you know, to commentate the freestyle. And it was very, very bent over, of course. A lot of their techniques, very low to the ground. But that's freestyle. That's what you expect. And some of their counter techniques were amazing. Very, very seldom did they turn their back on anybody because otherwise they gave their back. Greco-Roman, when I did the second part of the week for Greco, totally different techniques, totally different. So I think judo's gone the same way, you know. So we've done the same, and when that absolutely cemented it for me that they are two different things.
Yeah, there's a lot of clamor for bringing back leg grabs, but as you say, I think the sport itself is a bit probably tidier, and it's often more exciting, I think. Sticky sometimes. It could just get a little bit scrappy, couldn't it?
I think it could get scrappy, and I think another great advantage is that we really pushed hard to get the niwaza elongated, you know, so that we had longer in niwaza, and your coaches weren't teaching it anymore with the transitions because everybody was getting stood up, you know, so that was one thing that we really all pushed hard for.
Neil, moving forward and looking to the future, where do you see yourself sort of going from now, and what do you still see yourself doing in the future? More of the same or something different?
Well, I mean, this has been good for me in some ways. You know, the lockdown has, we built a dojo for filming purposes, you know, so we have an online business which is for technical online resources, and so that was always, so we wanted to see if, you know, we could build that bit side of the business. I absolutely love my work with the IJF. I've had 12 years with them, and it's something that I come in, I do my job, and I leave, you know, so it's not like talking with them all the time, or it's, you know, I've just had a really good relationship with them. They've left me to do my job. And so if I can do that for the next 5, 6, 7 years, then great. If they get rid of me, I'll be all right. But I hope they don't. I'd like to, you know, you can keep your voice going for a little bit longer than your physical side. You know, bits of me have started falling off now, but I'm still there and I'm still able to demonstrate to a fairly high level. So I want to keep that going for as long as I can.
Yeah, I think from a personal view, I think, like I just said, like watching judo without your voice, and it would be a totally different experience for me. Neil, in terms of content, great and good content, where can I go to find this stuff that you're talking about, especially stuff with the bands? Just advice to anyone that's watching that wants some nice technical content.
Just go to naeffectivefighting.com or just put Neil Adams Judo, and then they'll find links for it. But naeffectivefighting.com will take them straight to the website. Lots of technical stuff, and hopefully the quality that we want.
And you can see Neil dancing if you really want to have a bit of fun there as well.
Hey, my wife always said to me, she said, if I could dance as well as I do with Chikomi, so that was it, wasn't it? That was the thing to do.
I think there's a big connection between being able to dance and being able to do uchikomi, like especially timing and movement and stuff like that. I think there's
a... Yeah, well, my girls say that I dance like... what did they say? Like a typical guy, you know, like a typical dad. I said, that's a typical dad, for Christ's sake.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for coming on, and thank you for talking about all the highs and lows of your career. You're an absolute star, and I look forward to seeing you soon when the lockdown's over. But thank you for coming on.
It's an absolute pleasure, guys. I can't say how much of a pleasure it's been.
Yeah, I'll just second that from Denny as well. Yeah, it's been amazing to sit here and chat to you about all this kind of stuff and learn all these things from your experience. So, yeah, thank you once again.
Hey, listen, stay safe, and I look forward to us all getting together and being able to have a drink. An alcoholic one for me.
Oh, me too, Neil. I don't drink either, so perfect.
I'll just be me then. I'll be the one looking bad.
Doesn't matter. Hey, I've got a good bar here anyway, so you'll have to come and visit the dojo.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I'm only in Moseley, Neil.
There you go. Just down the road. You're welcome anytime. I mean it.
Thank you very much.
Lockdown.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Okay. See you soon.
See you. Right. Take care. Good luck with the baby.
Cheers. Thank you. Thank you, Neil.
Get some sleep.
I was going to get it in now.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Danny, how good was that?
Really amazing. I mean, especially in today's climate with the mental health stuff and to have someone who's reached some sort of ultimate highs in terms of Olympic and world and European success to sort of hit bottom and then come out on the other side and find his identity again. It's just a nice story and beautifully told by Neil himself. So,
well, that's what you come to expect from the voice of Gino, that when he does tell a story, you tend to listen to it. as you said there, like everybody knows about the highs of Neil's career, and learning a little bit about the lows and specifically how low it got at times was quite insightful, I think, and it's something that I think today's fighters can really take something from. And
it's very real. It's a very real story. Like you see all these people with mass success, and you don't get to sort of feel the pressure, hear the comments, like and obviously everyone goes through a sort of that loss of identity. Like, who am I now? And what an example. And I'd advise anyone, if they ever get the chance, to go and talk to him, and anyone who's been through that sort of experience, go and talk, because you'll get the realness from it, not the sort of soundbite, the real sort of emotional side to it, and how it affected and why it affected. And I think there's mass learning to be done at this time. Just talk more, to people, talk to everyone, like, because people are going through the same stuff, or will go through the same stuff, and you're in a performance environment, you're expected to perform. So, when it all goes away, it's what are you left with? So just, make sure.
I thought it was absolutely amazing to hear that from somebody as accomplished as him as well. But that brings us to the end of this week's Final Block podcast. Thank you once again for joining me, Dan.
Thank you. A pleasure.
And we'll look forward to having some more interesting chats with people from the World Class Performance Program next time. Cheers, Dan.
Thank you.
Everybody.